that we start. Honorable Kenya and the Deputy Minister. Honourable members, welcome to our committee meeting. We also welcome the Department of International Relations led by Deputy Minister Lenders. But I think it is in order, very much in order, that we should also introduce, perhaps allow Deputy Minister Lenders to introduce the Deputy Minister, and the Deputy Minister to introduce the gentleman who is in your office and the, any other person who was not here last week, just for the purpose of today. Deputy Minister.
Chairperson, thank you, and thank you for having us once again. It's my honor and pleasure to present to you and members of the Portfolio Committee the good lady seated next to me on my right, Regina Mhaule.
Mhaule.
Yes, Mhaule. Please remember the pronunciation, because she's advised me that a lot of people actually get the pronunciation horribly wrong. May I also, Chair, with your permission, then also present the rest of the team?
Yeah.
All right. gentleman on Ms. Kalyan's far left is Zahir Lahe. He is the Director, United Nations Security Council. Next to him is someone most of you know very well, Zahir Amin, who is my head of office. I can't see all the way down on my side, but they will raise their hands or stand. Lebogang Mashaba. He is PLO Parliamentary Liaison Officer for DM Mhaule. And then we have Ms. Swazi Dai Dai. Yes, okay, I'm coming to her. She, Swazi, is the PLO Parliamentary Liaison Officer for Minister Sisulu. Between Lebogang and Swazi is Sharon Horton. She's part of the ministry support staff.
I like Sharon Height.
Height. Okay. And then last but not least, I hope he's here, Sunnyboy Mbazima. He's not here, forgive me. That's the rest of our team, Chairperson.
DM Mhaule, from our side, we have members that start with Kalyan. Kalyan?
I'm Sandy Kalyan, a member of this committee.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Dimeo Raputi. I'm the member of this committee. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Tandwe Kenya, member of this committee. Thank you.
Morning. Wana Makwete Rinilo Masavela, member of this committee. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Lois Mpumlwana. I'm also borrowed to this committee.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm Sipho Seze, the surname is Masang. I'm chairperson of this committee. On behalf of my colleagues, Deputy Minister Mhauli. We want to extend our warm welcome and our congratulations to yourself on your appointment as a Deputy Minister in the Department of International Relations. And of course, you've just joined a team of two, the Minister and the Deputy Minister, who has been with us for quite some time. We've had very cordial, very constructive engagement with the leadership of the department, getting briefings on any other topic that we think will assist the committee to ask better and quality questions, better and quality statements, and debates, etc., etc. So we'll have very good relations. That's the team that you are joining, both in the department and in parliament. And we, not because you come from Mpumalang, but I also note that the presidents, when it comes to the ladies, both the former president and the current president, they ensure that you are not just brainy, but photogenic when they appoint ministers. If you have looked at Minister Nkwanamaite Mashabane and Noma Indian Fegeto and Sisuk, manje na ungenela. Yeah, but I am telling you, the mundo uraite na. Yeah, I just got a note. Oh, yes, I'm advised that we omitted to introduce the staff. Let's just quickly run through that for the Deputy Minister and then get into our business.
Morning, everyone. My name is Bongile Maputi. I'm media comms person assigned to the committee.
Thank you.
Morning, members. I'm Dineo Masala, the content advisor for the committee.
Who's my dad?
Morning, honorable members. My name is Jeff Masala, and I'm the researcher for the committee.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Zubamari.
Thank you very much. Let's deal with apologies. Secretary, can we record apologies? Those who are going to live early and those who are not here, those who are sick.
Thank you, Chair. We have four apologies, Chair. One from Honorable S. Mokhalaba is out of the country on political party business. And another one from Honorable T. Bachman. The third one from Honorable Klengwa is attending another meeting. And the fourth one from Honorable Fitad is attending a conference outside of Parliament. And then we have another apology from Honorable Kalyan, who will be leaving the meeting at 11. And also, Honorable Mbumlwana will be attending another meeting shortly. Thank you, sir.
What about Honorable Maila? But he hasn't said that.
No, sir, I don't receive, sir, but I will take it that you are submitting on his behalf.
Well, I heard that he is not well, but it was not recorded.
Yes, I know he is not well.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you. Now, there is our agenda. I want to request to insert just one item, an update on the Foreign Service Bill process, update on the Foreign Service Bill under just between 4 and 5, so that we can talk about our intended visit to to Pretoria to meet the public service bargaining council as well as the Association of Former Ambassadors and High Commissioners, and our intended travel to Namibia to inspect the properties of the department. So we want to give you an update on that one. So that's the insertion I was requesting to make. Can I then hear you on the agenda, colleague? You move that it be adopted. Seconder and seconder, seconded by Honorable Raputi. Thank you very much. We then defer now to the Deputy Minister Lenda to lead us together with his team on the presentation that we have today. And it is a briefing by the Department on the reform of the Security Council, the United Nations Security Council. Over to you, DM.
Honorable Chair, thank you. I'm going to hand over to the capable hands of Mrs. Zahir Laher, Director, UN Security Council, to make the presentation. I trust that everyone has the hard copy, failing which I understand he's going to make a PowerPoint presentation as well. So without further ado.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Deputy Minister. Good morning, colleagues and members of the committee. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to brief you on the issue that you have requested, the issue related to the reform of the Security Council. The presentation that we have prepared focuses on two issues, and they lead, one leads into the other. The first is the issue of reform. Well, what's the status of reform? What are the proposals on the table at the moment? And then leading into the contemporary issue, which is South Africa's candidature. As some of you may be aware, South Africa has put forward its candidature to be elected as an elected member of the Security Council for 2019-2020. So I'll start with reform itself. What we have basically tried to indicate is the context that we find ourselves in. The Security Council was created in a particular context. It was created in the aftermath of the Second World War. It reflects the reality of the world as it was in 1945. So what we have is 10 elected members and 5 permanent members, making up 15 members of the council. The 5 permanent members are the victors of the Second World War, the 5 powers that possessed nuclear weapons at the end of the Second World War, and the 10 elected members are chosen from the different geographical regions within the UN system. So what we find is that from the 15, we have 5 from Western Europe in total. That includes the 3 permanent members. Well, it's Western Europe and other groups. It's a group basically made up of developed countries. So it includes the United States, the United Kingdom, France, and then 2 elected members. So developed countries make up 1/3 of the 15. The other 10 seats are divided among the other sub-regions. There are 3 from Asia, which are 2 elected members and 1 permanent, which is China, 2 from Eastern Europe, 1 permanent, which is the Russian Federation, and 1 elected. And then Latin America has 2 members and Africa has 3 members. Latin America and Africa are the only 2 sub-regions which do not have a permanent member. Now, the question is, well, what is the relevance and what is the importance of being permanent? One, obviously, the main thing is the capacity, the ability to have institutional memory, to always be in the Security Council, to be permanently present on all matters related to international peace and security. But most importantly, permanent members, and you're probably aware of this, in terms of the Charter, have what has been called the right of veto. The Charter doesn't make provision or doesn't make any reference to this word veto, but what the Charter says in terms of Article 27 of the Charter is that no vote of the council will be adopted if any of the permanent members vote against it. So in other words, the permanent members can stop any resolution. We have seen resolutions, for example, on Israeli settlements in the past, where 14 members of the council have voted in favor of a resolution condemning Israeli settlements. One permanent member, in that case it was the United States, voted against the resolution, and the resolution is then not passed because a permanent member has exercised the right to veto. If a permanent member abstains from a vote, the vote should still be adopted. So a permanent member could abstain for a vote or vote in favor, and that's fine, but as long as a permanent member votes against the resolution, that resolution will not pass. So what you then have is that the reality is the council will never adopt a resolution that the permanent members do not want. It will never take action in a particular case if a permanent member is involved in a particular matter. So this is the context and the setting, and the reason why reform is necessary. It does not. It's a very odd situation that we have 72 years after the formation of the United Nations that we have an organization that reflects the world as it was in a particular period of time, a period of 1945. In 1945, when the UN was created, there were 50-some-odd member states. Today, there's 193 member states. Since then, you've had a series of several states in Asia and Africa in particular that have become independent. We've gone through a period of decolonization. So the world as it is today is very different. The powers that were the most powerful countries in 1945 are no longer the most powerful countries today, arguably. So what happened in 2005 is that the then Secretary General, Kofi Annan, had tried to put fresh impetus into this reform process, arguing that the organization needs to reform to reflect contemporary challenges. And it's not just reform of the Security Council, it's reform of the United Nations as a whole to make the organization more relevant. It's reform of the Economic and Social Council, reform of the General Assembly. The General Assembly is, and you are parliamentarians, you are well aware, the General Assembly is almost like the parliament of humankind. It is the place where all member states have a seat and all member states have equal vote. How do we make this? This should be the premier body of the United Nations and not necessarily the Security Council, which is just made up of an elite few. How do we make the Economic and Social Council, which is the body entrusted with economic and social development issues that are most relevant for developing countries, how do we strengthen that body of the United Nations? So what Kofi Annan tried to do was put fresh impetus into this reform debate. Emanating out of his proposals, there emerged various groupings within the United Nations General Assembly, putting forward proposals for reform. Unfortunately, what has happened, and it's natural, I guess, in that member states looked at their national interests and looked at how they can pursue their own particular interests in ensuring that their own countries and their own regions are reflected in the new power dynamic that would emanate out of a reformed United Nations and a reformed Security Council. So you had various groups emanating. For example, you had a group called the G4, which is made up of the four main aspirants, which is Germany, Japan, India, and Brazil. They argue for expansion of the Council in the permanent and elected category to ensure that they are given seats. You have a group called the Uniting for Consensus, who argue that you should not be creating new permanent members, you should just be expanding the Council to ensure that countries go in for a longer period of time as elected members, because if you create more permanent members, you're actually perpetuating inequality, because you're creating more haves rather than ensuring that everybody is equal. So where does that leave South Africa, and where does it leave the continent? In 2005, when Kofi Annan came out with this proposal to reform and start a new process for negotiations on reforming the Council, African Union leaders met in Swaziland and adopted the African Common Position on UN reform, which is known as the Izulwini Consensus. The Izulwini Consensus is quite a comprehensive look at reform of all parts, all aspects of the United Nations. But when it looks at, and specifically it looks at the Security Council. And with regard to the Security Council, Africa argues for at least two permanent seats with veto rights and an increase of the non-permanent category as well. The one key issue is the issue of the veto. African countries have argued that the veto is something that should be done away with, it's unfair. However, as long as it remains, and as long as existing permanent members have the right to veto, then all members should have the right to veto. So if you have new permanent members, they should also be given the right to veto. Because if you have new permanent members and they are not given the right to veto, you will then have existing permanent members that have the right to veto and new permanent members that don't have that. So in an ideal scenario, you should have no veto. But as long as it remains, everyone should have it, whoever becomes permanent. Negotiation then started, and it takes place within the General Assembly in a forum called the IGN, the Intergovernmental Negotiations on Security Council Reform. And negotiations is a bit of a misnomer, because what we would expect in negotiations, we would expect countries to sit around a table and negotiate an outcome that would reach agreement. But negotiations began in this current format in 2008. And we are now, 10 years later, in 2018, we have not moved one inch in terms of progress or in terms of reaching agreement on reform. We've not even been able to reach agreement on a piece of paper that says that reform should take place in both categories, elected and permanent, or that there should be regional representation in an enlarged council. We have not been able to reach agreement on anything. And the reason being is that what happens in these negotiations is, and they happen periodically, these negotiating forums are convened two or three times a year by the President of the General Assembly. Member states come to these negotiations, or these so-called negotiations, and they present their position without engaging each other on their different perspectives. Additionally, there's no text on the table. And South Africa, what we have been calling for is that we need meaningful negotiations based on a text. And we've been calling on the President of the General Assembly to put forward a proposal for reform. Try to take all these different positions that I've outlined, the G4 position, the African Union position, the Uniting for Consensus position, put it all down on a paper, find convergences, and let us negotiate an actual outcome. But there's been reluctance to do this. And the reason and the reality is that some countries do not want reform. That's the reality. If there is going to be reform, there are going to be some countries that will be left out. There will be some countries that will now be included in a reform council. There will also be those countries, which is basically those that have the power today, that will have to share that power. That's basically the permanent members. Do they want to share that power? And that's a question that is constantly being asked. Incidentally, the UN Charter is very interesting. They created a safe mechanism for the permanent members, in that any amendment to the UN Charter, which basically would lead to reform, because you'd need to amend the Charter, needs to be agreed upon by the Security Council itself. So in other words, the permanent members would have to agree on any reform initiative. If they do not agree, they have the right to veto any attempt to reform the Council. So, so it's a very odd situation, and ultimately, we continue to participate in these negotiations. We hope that there would be progress, but as I indicated, in the last 10 years, there's been very little or no progress at all. South Africa participates in these negotiations. We call for reform based on the Islamini consensus, and we call for text-based negotiations, which would allow for meaningful negotiations. That then leads me on to our candidature for the Security Council in 2019-2020. While we await any progress on reform, we have committed as South Africa to be part of the Security Council whenever it is possible. And the manner in which it is possible to be part of the Council is to be elected as an elected member. So the elected members are the 10 members that go in for a two-year period. Africa, from those seats, Africa has three seats. Africa always has three seats as an elected member of the Council. And those three seats are shared among the African states of the United Nations. And how they are shared is basically, very simply, is that West Africa, because of the number of seats in West Africa, they have always a country from West Africa in the Security Council, which is currently occupied by Côte d'Ivoire, who has just started, and they will serve a two-year term. And then North and Central Africa share one seat, and they alternate. So there would be a North African country. After they serve their 2 years, a Central African country would take their seat. We, as Southern Africa, share a seat with East Africa. Currently, Ethiopia is serving a two-year term. Their term will end at the end of this year. And that seat then reverts to Southern Africa. when it does come back to Southern Africa, we have put forward our candidacy as the Southern African country to fill that seat. The Southern African group endorsed South Africa to serve as its representative when the seat becomes available once Ethiopia vacates that seat. The African Union summit in January endorsed the proposal put forward by the Southern African group. So the African Union has basically decided and endorsed South Africa as its candidate to serve on the Security Council for 2019-2020. And that seat, as I said, would become available from the beginning of 2019. The election will take place this coming June, on June the 8th. So what happens is you get elected on June the 8th, and should you be elected, you then have a period of 6 months to prepare for taking up your seat. So you build up your capacity in terms of getting up to speed on the different issues in the Security Council. You ensure that your mission is capacitated, your head office is capacitated to deal with the different issues. Moving on then to the slide. What is it, and the question then is, well, before I get to what is it that we hope to do when we're in the council, I should just add that how do you get elected is that you need two-thirds of the member states. You need the support of two-thirds of the member states to be elected. There are currently 193 member states in the United Nations General Assembly, so you roughly need 129 votes to get elected. We have started an intensive lobbying campaign as DERCO. The importance of ensuring that as many member states support you for your seat, for your candidature, allows you to have the legitimacy, that when you get elected onto the Security Council, you are able to argue that you are there because member states of the General Assembly have supported your candidature, and you have the mandate to represent them on all matters related to international peace and security. So all our missions have been instructed to engage with their host countries to request support and to indicate why we want to be in the council and what is it that we hope to do once we serve. You are aware, members of the committee, honourable members of the committee, that we have served as South Africa two previous times on the Security Council. We served for the first time ever in 2007 and 2008, and we served in 2011 and 2012. As members of the Security Council. In both those terms, we would argue that we were very active members of the Council. We particularly focused on the strategic cooperation and coordination between the United Nations and the African Union. We argued that unfortunately, many of the issues on the Security Council agenda are issues related to conflict on the African continent. Because of this, there is a strategic need for the African Union and the United Nations to cooperate and coordinate its action. When there is deployment of UN peacekeepers or African Union peacekeepers, this should be done in coordination. There are times, for example, we see in Somalia with AMISOM, the African Union operation in Somalia, where the United Nations is unwilling to deploy. Or in Darfur, where the UN was unable to deploy because the Sudanese government had been reluctant to have UN troops. So there are occasions where the UN is unwilling or unable to deploy, and the African Union is able to deploy. Those are occasions where there should be coordination, cooperation. The African Union should often does have the political will, but does not have the necessary capacity to deploy. So in these cases, the UN should be in a position to assist with capacity for the African Union deployment. So those are some of the issues we focused on. We had also chaired and South Africa has a particular contribution to make in the area of nuclear disarmament because of our own history pertaining to the nuclear disarmament debate. We had chaired the 1540 Committee of the Security Council, which relates to the issue of non-state actors gaining access to weapons of mass destruction. We have previously chaired the North Korea Sanctions Committee as well. So we have contributed in many ways, not just to African peace and security, but to global peace and security. So as we go into the Council in our next term, we hope to build on this. We hope to use our national experience of our own negotiating process, of adding value to the work of the Council in ensuring that there's global peace and security. We have chosen as a theme continuing the legacy, working for a just and peaceful world. This is tied in to the theme of the centenary of the birth of Nelson Mandela. We want to make use of the legacy and the values and principles of Madiba's vision for global peace and security, development, human rights, to ensure that we bring that to the work of the Council. Additionally, as you are probably aware, the African Union has committed to silencing the guns by the year 2020. It's an aspiration that the African Union has to end conflict on the continent by 2020. For South Africa to be in the Security Council during this period, as we reach that target date, it will allow us to contribute in the global premier body dealing with international peace and security. It will allow us to contribute and work towards this goal. We envisage that some of the priorities that we will be dealing with as we go into the Council, we would want to continue. As I said, the priorities would be to pursue the African agenda, peaceful resolution of conflict, strengthening of multilateralism. That is an important aspect in terms of how we see this is something we have continuously spoken about as DELCO, that we believe in the concept of multilateralism and collective action. When we deal with something like Syria, where you have a war that is continuing for several years, and if we do not have, we have particular countries, you see that in other cases as well in the world, in Yemen, etc., where particular countries are fighting particular battles, and if there's no collective action to try and resolve that, you will not have a solution to the conflict. We need global, cohesive, multilateral action to resolve global challenges. That doesn't only work for peace and security, it also works for issues like human rights, issues like migration, issues on development, implementation of the Sustainable Development Goals. The key hotspots that South Africa is expected to focus on as we go into the Council and we look at some of the issues that the Council is currently grappling with. On the African continent, there's issues related to the Democratic Republic of Congo as we move to in this very difficult year of the DRC as it moves towards an election target date. There's issues related to Somalia, South Sudan, in Mali and the wider Sahel region. There's also, of course, the continual issue of the self-determination of the people of Western Sahara, which remains an issue on the Security Council agenda because you have a UN mission on the ground that is there it's supposed to have coordinated the holding of a referendum. And we will continue to ensure that the rights of the Sahrawi people and the right to self-determination is pursued. The key thematic issues that we are anticipating that will come up are issues related to terrorism. On terrorism, one of the key aspects that the Council is now dealing with is how do you deal with countering violent extremism. This is an issue that is affecting many developed countries, many countries all around the world, but even developing countries face this problem, that you have violent extremism on the rise, you have foreign terrorist fighters, you have returned terrorist fighters that come back to your country, etc. These are some of the issues that it deals with. Key issues that the Council continue to deal with relate to women, peace and security. How do you ensure that, and children in armed conflict, that people, the most vulnerable people in conflict situations, how are they affected by the conflict and how do we ensure that they are protected? We expect, and as my conclusion, I would say that we expect, and we've done a formula in terms of when would South Africa preside over the Council. During your term as an elected member, you will preside over the Council for 1 month or 2 months, depending on the rotation. We expect that South Africa would preside over the Council in September 2019. And if that is the case, that will be during the month in which the UN traditionally has its high-level week. If that is the case, and it does happen in that way, then the President would be expected to preside over the Council during that month. So, Chair and members of the committee, broadly speaking, that brings my presentation to an end. We'll be glad to take any questions, but we wanted to sketch out the progress with regard, or the lack of progress with regard to reform of the Council, but also indicate to you some of the issues we're dealing with currently, which is South Africa's candidature, which we hope will allow us an opportunity to be part of the Security Council, despite it not being reformed, but as an elected member, and be in a position to contribute to international peace and security. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lahier. Thank you very much for your very informative presentation on the reform of the Security Council as well as the candidature of South Africa for non-permanent membership in the Security Council. Can I invite questions and comments from the members? Our members? Hello, Kenya. Honorable Raputi. Honorable Kalyan. Hello, Kenya. You are on the floor.
Thank you, Sebastian. Thank you for the presentation, right? My question was the only, you said that the United Nations Security Council was established in 1945. You even talked about the war between and also other elected members. As you know that the mandate of this Security Council was to maintain international peace and security according to the UN Charter. Is there any strategy to lobby for increase? Now we say that we're talking about the 193 states. That is now, because now due to revolution, the numbers have increased. That is said, is there a strategy for the Southern Africa or the Africa to lobby? Also, on the issue of the loan consensus, as you know, that it's an African position on proposed reform. Is there any possibility of negotiating for two permanent seats in the African continent? I understand that US, UK, and France are permanent five peace. Maybe I don't know whether it's because of the talk about chemical the continent. I don't know why. Maybe how was it calculated it's five peace. That Latin America and that Latin America and Africa do not have permanent members. What is the rationale? Also, the permanent members have these veto powers that they can stop any decision that is taken by the majority of the council. I think I that's a comment because I can't ask you why. Maybe there is a need, the comments that there is a need really to lobby for evolution of this power, of that article that talks to the top power voice to give a few people to reverse the decision of those majority it doesn't sound nice. Also in 1965 member states were increased. Oh, I've asked that question. But I just want to check, maybe coupled with that question I asked about this 5P. What was the criteria? Maybe it is there, I don't know. What are the criteria for choosing that 5P alone to be increased? Not the non-member, the non-permanent, and that the non-permanent members were not given the status of being increased or being translated to the permanent. Also, on the endorsement of certain candidates in January 2018 on the UN Summit General Assembly, looking at the delay of implementation of those decisions that were taken in 2008, 10 years down the line. Now, Southern Africa, I guess I understand that Southern Africa has agreed to all candidates for South Africa on the non-permanent seat, but we are left with only 2 months now to change them again. Is there progress in lobbying? Because you can't be just sure that we are being supported. But there must be a clear a definition of the progress on the lobbying. Thank you very much, Sir.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kenya. For those who don't know, the place Ezulwini is in Swaziland, but I like the name in English, Heaven. So, which means Heaven Consensus. I like it that way. Honorable Puti?
Thank you very much for the presentation. It's not a question, but it's as a visionary leader. I don't see any way that South Africa is not going to be endorsed. Seeing that it was endorsed by the African Union, and I'm also of the view that it won't, we won't have any challenges to be accepted in the United in the United Nations Security Council, especially with that two terms, that the role that they played a very important role, especially on the issue of this when they even sponsored that resolution on that you said that especially on the plight of the women and the plight of the children. So I don't think that there is any country that will really deny South Africa to be part of this Security Council. And especially when they are going to bring such lot of reform in that Security Council, it's going to be really a cherry on top of the cake for South Africa to be part of that Security Council. And I'm hopeful that Minister and Deputy Ministers that really we are, you know, they're waiting for us to be part of that United Nations Security Council. I thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Puti. Honorable Kalyan, you're on the floor.
Thank you, Chairperson. I get the sense that the UN is, quite frankly, a toothless body because it doesn't, well, it's long past its sell-by date in the mandate that it originally was mandated to do. And there have been several attempts at trying to reform it, but it would seem like the powers that be or the countries that have the power are clinging to it and are not serious about the world threats at the moment. Listening to you and hearing that for the past 10 years we haven't moved an inch closer to any kind of resolution, and that there were certain flaws in the high-level panel report that was presented. Does the Ezulwini report also have any potential? Is it being taken seriously? Do you think that what is recommended in it has got serious kind of, you know, that people will take it seriously? I can't really see a threat, and perhaps you could address this. What is the threat that they, or the resistance? What is the resistance to the reform? Then the AU also, I've read the resolution, and it's quite a powerful resolution, and I have no doubt that it will sustain, given that in the past we've had over 90% support for South Africa. But one of the things that the AU is calling upon is for the debt cancellation for poor countries. Is that a realistic thing? I understand that poor countries, you know, they're poor, they can't, you know, survive themselves. But is that a realistic thing? And who then, if you cancel it, who then assumes that responsibility? And my last question there has been a lobby group going on for also more than 10, 12 years. And I've heard it at the IPU, and I've heard it at other places, that there is a move to form a UN parliamentary assembly. Your thoughts and comments on such a move? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kalyan. Honorable Mashabela, do you have anything? You're on the floor.
Thank you. Thanks very much for the presentation. The Security Council is still dominated by the same past permanent members all those years ago, being the five great powers that have just won the war. The people of the Global South especially do not see themselves adequately represented in the Council. What is the role of South Africa in matters of the continent? And again, if South Africa has a strong pan-Africanist African policy, I think South Africa does not push enough. And again, what will be our renewed focus now after the wasted 10 years under Zuma's poor policy making? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mashabela. Mr. Lahir, thank you very much for your presentation. Where do I start? I want to start with the mandate of the United Nations, either Security Council or the United Nations. It is the maintenance of international peace and security. And I think the emphasis is on peace and security. The reason being that it was pursuant to the First and the Second World War. And after the Second World War, in the Second World War, Germany, Japan and Italy were accused of having caused those wars because they had contempt for the League of Nations. Now that threat is over, and now that the other threat, if I should call it that way, the Cold War is over since 1989, why would the P5 not allow a region such as Africa, which was excluded then, and then it was not part of the process of the Second World War, or of the First World War, so to speak, you see. Because if they must maintain international peace and security, Africa was not a cause in the First World War. Africa was not a cause in the Second World War. And during the Cold War played itself out in the African theater, not as a cause, but the superpowers played themselves out here in Africa. Now, why would, and I'm not sure if collectively or singularly, would there be states that think the membership of the African continent into the Security Council would constitute a threat to international peace? You see, because I would have thought that because we never caused any instability to anybody as an African region, in fact, we should be a welcome candidate to be a permanent member there. Now, whether we have veto, whether we would have veto powers or not veto powers is another thing. But I would support that if we become a member of the Security Council permanent, we should have the same rights and privileges to have a veto power. Because depending on where you stand as a country or as a region, sometimes you felt that the veto right has been abused. If one of the countries votes against a decision of the settlement of the illegal settlement of the Israelis into the Palestinian territory, against, which was a violation of international law. You remember the resolution that was issued by the General Assembly, that this is a violation of the international law. When you are discussing the two-state solution, then you are settling that. And of course, the resolution that was, the decision that was taken in the Knesset in Israel, that once people have settled somewhere there, then it becomes legal retrospectively. Now, if you veto that, you are bound to feel that those who are supporting Palestine will feel that this veto has been abused. Then I will not go into history. The same will apply about Western Sahara and others and others and others. So, now, with regard to, and it could be extraneous if I say that there is this view by some political scientists that what you see in Syria is a, in quotes, is a second world war, Cold War, second Cold War playing itself out in Syria, and that it will not easily end because it depends on who the regime that must take over there, in whose interest would you have that regime? You see, if, for instance, China and Russia feel that under Assad, then we have our person there, and the USA feels otherwise, or France feels otherwise, so you're going to have that kind of a thing over and over, not being solved, running over and over for many years. But I think it's an extraneous matter because our focus here is on the membership of the continent into the Security Council. And then, I was going to ask you whether there are outside the Cold War now, whether there are any geostrategic considerations that they could include, you know, any possibility of a world war, trade, and other balance of forces considerations. That would say, we think if you bring in Africa, you actually are bringing an enemy region. You are actually adding a voice or a grouping that adds to whoever are the perceived enemies. I'm not sure if it would be the entire P5, considering the African continent as an enemy region, such that they mustn't sit here because of the following considerations. It is not in the interest of international peace. But let me lastly say that as a committee, I think we should support. We should support the Ezulwini consensus. We should also express our gratitude about the African Union endorsing that particular view for the two permanent seats, as well as the recent endorsement of our candidature in January for South Africa to be to have a seat as a non-permanent member. Now, lastly, I see that even if South Africa becomes Africa becomes a permanent member, or South Africa is a non-permanent member, there are countries that have for their own national interest, have stuck to the unilateralist approach. If they want it, they go for it. They don't care who says what. So when we say we will go there and push the multilateral approach, which is a consensus approach, everybody must agree, don't attack Iraq or don't attack Syria. But if one country, which is a hegemon, feels that it is in their interest to do so, they'll do so, and they've done so without any consequence. So I see that we're going to have a challenge of multilateralism against unilateralism. And unilateralism is a minority view, serving a minority interest, obviously. So we're going to be seated with a challenge. I'm not sure if you would like to make any comment, given the lessons of history, of course. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Sorry, Chair, before I have to leave for another conference now, a round table. Would it be possible for my question to be answered first? Or should I wait for the transaction?
No. Let him start with your question. And we must also extract information from you about the Pan-African Parliament. Yeah, you've been sitting there for quite some time. You and you should be five, no? Yeah. I think it could be very helpful to get everything from you. Yeah. Start with a question, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members, for your very useful questions. And many of them are interrelated, actually. But I'll try to start with the questions raised by Honorable Killian. Firstly, your point about the UN long past its sell-by date and whether the UN is still relevant. The reality, and to a large extent, what you say about the ineffectiveness of the UN is something we cannot disagree with. The UN is, we've seen the conflict in Syria continue for so many years, with conflict, with people dying. It's in our TV screens. You see that in many other parts of the world, Somalia, the Sahel, terrorism continues. The question we often ask ourselves is that if we do not have the UN, if the UN was dismantled tomorrow, we would have to form something like the UN in any event, because there is a need for collective action. We cannot resolve climate change as one country sitting by ourselves, or as the African continent, without looking at the major emitters of greenhouse gases. We cannot resolve terrorism as one country or as a continent or a region. There needs to be global collective action to resolve all these cross-cutting issues. Development cross-cuts so many different issues, migration, etc. So it's the same with peace and security. There are very few conflicts. Well, there are conflicts that are between or within states, intrastate conflicts, etc. But major conflict in the world does have ramifications for many more countries than just the countries or parties involved in the conflict. So we would then find that we would need to come together to form something. And the question then is, what is that something? Here we have a body. We have a body that is the largest intergovernmental organization that we have. It is made up of virtually every state, not every state, but virtually every state in the world that is members to this organization. This organization deals with issues from intellectual property rights to nuclear disarmament, global health issues, etc. What we argue for is that we have an organization that is imperfect. It has many faults. We have to find ways, as a responsible member of the international community, to try and fix it. And they have these proposals, and reform is part of that. Yes, it is slow. It is not moving at all. Maybe slow is actually the wrong word. It's just not even moving. Slow means that it's moving somewhere. But it is important that South Africa, that is a country that believes in collective action, that believes that we cannot go it alone. We need to find ways that we try and fix this organization. And that's why we will continue with our principal view. And it comes to, it touches on what you have said, Chair, and what other members have said about Izumini and our principal position with regard to the veto, with regard to expansion, to ensure that all regions of the world are represented in the permanent category, all regions of the world have the same rights and powers. So the question then is, and it also touches on the question raised by Honorable Kellyanne, but also others, what is the resistance to reform? Why is it that we don't have reform? And the issue is that if we are to have reform, there's the haves and the have-nots. If we are going to give the have-nots something that the haves have to give up something. And that is the problem. Who will lose out if we are to have reform? If tomorrow morning we wake up and there is reform and Africa has a permanent seat and Latin America has a permanent seat and we have the right to veto, power has then been dissolved. You have given, the P5 have given up some of their power to others. And there is reluctance for that. Also, who will be those countries that will go in? If we say Africa has a seat, we are saying a specific country in Africa or specific countries if it's going to be more than one. And specific countries in Latin America that will be given those seats. So who will be those? So if there are specific ones that go in, there will be others that will not have it. And those, and countries know it. They know that we do not stand a chance, so we have to try and block reform. That's the reality. The reality is the P5, the reality is some countries within the General Assembly that are part of the have-nots, that know that they will remain part of the have-nots should the Council be reformed. And that's why there is this reluctance to a large extent. Unfortunately, as I said earlier, the Charter is designed in a very peculiar way. And of course, it's designed in a manner in which the P5 protected themselves, that you need a Charter amendment to ensure that there is reform. And for a Charter amendment, you need two-thirds majority of the General Assembly, as well as the concurrence of the Security Council. So in other words, they have ensured that they would have any say over a Charter amendment. You cannot amend the Charter without the P5 agreeing to it. So they have to agree to give up that power. And, you know, there's a very peculiar issue in the Council. Just to show you how outdated the UN is, the UN Charter refers to enemy states. Up till today, there's references in the UN Charter to enemy states. And enemy states are the enemy states of 1945, that's Germany and Japan. These Germany and Japan today are the second and third largest contributors to the UN budget. They have tried to amend the Charter, but they have failed. And if there is to be meaningful reform, if you look at the globe today, if you look at who are the most powerful countries in Europe, for example, Germany would be way up there. Perhaps the two that are there from Western Europe today may not be part of the P5, you know, if you look at who are really the global powers. But Germany has failed to try and succeed in getting a Charter amendment to remove reference to enemy states in an organization in which it contributes a large part of its budget to. And that's because countries, the P5 in particular, are reluctant to change that. They argue that they suffered at the hands of the German aggression, at the hands of Japanese aggression during the Second World War, and we cannot change what the Charter says. So there are these difficult things, these countries that hold on to power, that are reluctant to ensure that they change. But the point being is that as developing countries, as countries on the African continent, we have to continue. We have to continue to ensure that our voice is heard, that we call for reform, we actively engage within the UN system, and that is why we also want to go back into the Council. We don't go into the Council because we want to go there and say, oh, well, we are now elected, we have shown that we are popular enough to be elected. But we want to go back into the Council and make a meaningful contribution to global peace and security, which is the mandate of the Council. And we believe as South Africa that we can contribute to that. We are doing it. We are already deploying peacekeepers in parts of the world, particularly on the continent. We are engaged in mediation efforts, and we can contribute to global peace and security. When it comes to the nuclear disarmament debate, we have a contribution to make. When it comes to issues related to the conflict in Western Sahara, we have a position and we have proposals on Palestine, etc. So these are some of the contributions we can make. Sorry, the one question I wanted to touch on Volkerian, that I have not touched on very quickly, is the issue of the Parliamentary Assembly. which is slightly different to this topic, but it is in a way related. There is a proposal indeed by civil society organizations to create a parliamentary assembly. And the argument that they've put forward, and I think it's still in its infancy, this proposal, that you need elected representatives, in the way that you have a Pan-African parliament, you need a parliament at the United Nations, where you have elected representatives, members of parliament, a global parliament or as such. I think it's something we will continue to follow. One issue that we always argue that the General Assembly, in a way, is a global parliament, as it is now. It may not be a parliament in the manner in which you have your parliament as elected representatives voted on by people, or the Pan-African parliament, but it is a parliament in that every member state is elected to be, is part of it, and the ideal is, and those of us that are democracies within the General Assembly, governments are elected, and governments are represented. Not all governments are represented, not all governments are elected, but we are, in South Africa, we have a democratic government that's elected, that takes its place at the General Assembly. So when we speak, the ideal, and that's why these kind of briefings where we engage with members of parliament is very important, because we are not there representing our own positions. We represent that of an elected government. So the question then is the General Assembly not that forum? And that's a question we will have to debate when these proposals are put forward. Are we not just replicating something else by creating a world parliament when you already have, will we be weakening the General Assembly? Because one of the issues we call for in South Africa is that in the absence of meaningful reform of the Security Council, we should strengthen the General Assembly. So that's a democratic body. Whether you, a small island state like Marshall Islands or you China, you have one vote and you have the same equal weight. And the General Assembly, incidentally, has been able to act when the Security Council has not. Recently, the Security Council was unable to vote on it because of a veto of the United States on the issue of Jerusalem, when on the status of Jerusalem. The matter was then taken to the General Assembly, and the General Assembly, by an overwhelming majority, took a decision declaring that decision was illegal. So there are cases where the General Assembly is able to act in a more democratic manner when the Security Council is unable to. But it's something we will continue to follow.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think I've more or less covered, in a way, I've covered some of the questions that the other honorable members have raised in terms of the issue of what is the resistance to membership. How the P5s came about, I think this is, in a way, I've touched on that. This is a reality of the global situation of 1945. And the resistance to reform is precisely that there is an unwillingness to give up that power. In terms of our progress for lobbying, we hope, and I take the confidence that you have put forward in our lobbying campaign. We hope that we are able to get as many votes as possible to get elected as a elected member. Our missions are intensified, the engagement, our principles, whenever we have bilateral engagements, etc., the issue of South Africa's candidature is raised to ensure that we get the highest number of support to get elected into the Security Council. Lastly, I think the one thing I did not touch on, and I don't know if DM, you may want to also touch on this issue of the evaluation of the veto. There is a proposal by some member states, including, incidentally, France, which is a permanent member of the Council, to restrict the use of the veto, that the veto should not be used in cases of gross human rights situations. So when there's genocide occurring or gross human rights situations, that no country should be allowed to use the veto. And there should be guidelines prepared related to the use of the veto. The veto is not exercised often. The problem with the veto is that sometimes the threat is worse than the actual veto. Often countries will not take proposals to the Security Council because they fear that their veto will be used. So there is initiatives to try and find ways to restrict the use of the veto, because the veto in itself is a very unfair, because if there is gross human rights abuses, a country can be protected if it has a permanent member on its side, because there will be no action taken in that case. But this is something that member states are concerned with, or at least some of us are concerned with.
Thank you.
I think that more or less the issues that we have raised in a broad sense. I don't know if there's any follow up or if I've missed anything. Thank you.
Yeah.
Chair, my thanks to Mr. Leha. I just want to touch on the veto rights being abused, which is a point you raised, Chairperson. I think this is probably the biggest cause of concern because many people and member states of the UN believe that the veto right is being abused and that this is where the reform should happen. Of course, our view goes further than that, but we've covered that. Now, the High Commissioner in Geneva, High Commissioner of the UN Human Rights Council, has put forward or proposed the idea of a code of conduct for the veto. Whether this will find favor with the P5 is another matter altogether. And he uses the example, which is current, of Syria. Al-Bashir, the head of state of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, is not liked by countries of the West, but he is supported by Russia. And so you have a situation where members of the P5 are engaged in the conflict in Syria. Russia backs al-Assad and Syrian government forces, and America, who's also a P5 member, together with other P5 members, backs the rebels. Al-Assad has used chemical weapons, there's proof of that, Chairperson. But if the matter were to be referred to the Security Council for its consideration and resolution, Russia, being a P5 member, would veto it. Now, that's one example of why there should be a code of conduct for the use of the veto. The other examples, of course, are Yemen, amongst others. Now, Mr. Laha is quite right. Once you give someone power, that person never voluntarily will say, I'm a big man, I'm bigger than all this, you've given me this power, I'm now giving it back to you. Once you've obtained power, you hang on to it for dear life. And as a consequence, Chairperson, more and more there are people who are beginning to speak about rejecting the authority of the UN Security Council, and they are also very strongly questioning the legitimacy of the UN Security Council simply because its P5 members have been allowed to act with impunity. There's no consequence for the things they do because they have the veto power. Now, when will the international community rise up, however they may seek to do that, it's hard to say. And as you pointed out to me, Chairperson, it's as though the UN Security Council P5 members have their hands around our throat, and as and when they feel like it, they squeeze and let go, depending on the environment and the climate. So that essentially is where we're at right now, and it's sad that the proposal put forward by Kofi Annan weren't taken as seriously as they should have, because I believe that at that time he sincerely wanted to bring about proper and tangible reforms to this important body. That's the only addition I thought I should make to the comments and questions, Chairperson.
But I don't know if you're...
No, okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Deputy Minister, for your insightful and useful comments. And also, let's extend our thanks to you, Mr. Lahir. Oh, you want to come back out of Kenya? Yes, yes. Because I'm almost closing off on that matter. Yes, come in.
Comment, it's not a question, but it's just a comment. And now that there's this what is said, that the P5 associated to the associated with the nuclear weapons in 1945. So that's why they were established anyway. My problem is that it seems as if this is a threat to the primary responsibility of the maintenance of global peace security in terms of the UN Charter, taking note of what the President has said about the Syria and also the UN. Well, to my understanding, South Africa, as you know that, as South Africa, we champion peace, peacekeeping force mission. So now, what is worrying is that I remember sometime in other years that South Africa managed to assist Syria to in the destruction of chemical weapons. Now, it means that, to my understanding, there is a threat here if we say that we are going to keep... We are taking it lightly when I talk about this permanent position of the P5, knowing that very well they are also part of the conflict of Syria. Thank you, sir.
And the comment that Honorable Mashabela, that you are making. I slightly hold a different view that when it comes to matters international such as the UN Security Council or the General Assembly, what matters most is the collective stance, not of the individual president of a particular country, but of the Africa region. How do they present themselves there in the Security Council or in the General Assembly for Africa's interests? For me, at that level, it's the entire AU, because all the presidents, ultimately, they are in the AU, and then the AU, what does it say there for the Africa region? And as we are also aware, there are many regional groupings, you know, the groupings of the Americas, the groupings of the Asian countries, calling them that, the groupings of the Europeans under the European Union. Not. So, mainly, these groupings sit together and then say, we, as this region, are saying this. So, in the main, at international level, you want to enrich it.
You're perfectly correct, and in direct answer to your question about Africa, Mr. Lyer will confirm this because he's in New York City most of the time, that the Africa group, both in New York City and in Geneva, where the Human Rights Council is based, both bodies are very strong. And so when we land either in New York City or Geneva, one of the first stops we make, as a DM or as an ambassador, is to present yourself to the Africa group, and they will provide you with the opportunity and even ask you to address them, as I was asked to do in Geneva, because they were keen to hear about the changes now, with the removal of President Zuma and his place being taken by President Ramaphosa. So it's an important body. They have regular contacts with their head offices, like we do, and they are guided in that way. I'm not sure that it's the perfect system. I think that we could look at a more refined system, for example, Zaire, of voting instruction, whereby, and this is something I'm going to speak to the minister and my colleague here about. My sense is that over the years there hasn't been adequate link. We've left it to certain chief directors, and in the process they've sent across the wrong messages, and we found ourselves in trouble. And of course, because the instruction came from the chief director, politically there's little or nothing you can do. Whereas I would prefer that the voting instruction came from the minister, so that the team, either in Geneva or New York, then can say we were guided by our political principles, and that's why we took a particular position.
Thank you very much. Now, we said that there will be an update on a few processes regarding the bill. As members would remember, would rather be aware, we have said that we needed to have a consultation next week with the Public Service Bargaining Council, the PSBC, which was going to be on the 22nd, and that already accepted the invitation, and they gave us the names of the people who are going to make a presentation about what their take is on the foreign service bill. Then the next one, the following day, was the Association of Former Ambassadors and High Commissioners. Again, it was going to take place in Pretoria. The venue was secured, everything else was in place. And just to remind the members why we needed to go there, it was because when we invited the Association of Former Ambassadors and High Commissioners, only two people came, and they said it's because they don't have money. The chair, Ambassador Nene, came. So we decided that we'll go to them. Now, we have an application, and I accompanied the application in person to the office of the Chair of Committees, Honorable Frolic, because he did indicate in the meeting of the Committee of Chairpersons last week, Wednesday, that it is important that chairpersons, when they want to have delegations overseas, they also come and speak to him. And he indicated that study tours and other delegations, people wanted to go somewhere, was actually going to cost Parliament around 22 million. And they are disallowing all of these travels. So yesterday, I went to him and said, we want to go to Pretoria to meet the two structures, 22 and the 22nd and 23rd, for this particular reason. And we also want to go to Namibia because clause 8 of the bill deals with the assets, and these assets belong to, are managed and can only be disposed and what by the Department of Public Works. And there is this, Public Works, let me put it differently. Public Works feels that if the properties are given to DERCO, you are taking away a very important mandate away from them. So they feel that whether it's international or it's national, but they exist to manage, to refurbish, to renovate, to do anything about state property. So they are jealously guarding that mandate or that task. So I then said, we want a joint visit to Namibia.
But the list, is referring to a number of countries. Unfortunately, honorable members, this was not allowed, citing money as a reason, that all the committees between now and the 30th in this financial year, there is no money in Parliament, they will not allow committees to travel. So they later looked at the calendar and they have emailed and told to the PA, to the chairperson, as well as the committee secretary, the dates in which they think we can go to meet the PSPC as well as the Association of Former Ambassadors. But also, when we're discussing early April, again, there was a problem of the Parliament is in short recess, and members are supposed to concentrate on their constituency work, depending on the mandate of their parties. But what he was saying was that most likely for all parties, it will be a voter registration. So then they emailed a date for us that please look at the 18th and the 19th. Or is it 17 and 18, Sequela?
18 and
19. So we may have to work around that particular logistic. But also, we, in the application, then must also include Namibia, right? So that we deal with the two, we also go to Namibia. Then, what I'm going to request once we have run these two, meeting once a week is not going to work. Because then Frolic was asking me, when do you think you're going to be done with this bill? And it's been on your lap for a long time. So we may have to meet either twice a week, or we may have to have long meetings in the evening. In the evening, so that we deal with this with this matter expeditiously and be done by, I don't know, you will decide, but perhaps by May. Because this year we have a short year because of the campaigns. After June, many parties will be going for campaigns and elections and all those things. So we need to be done with it. Again, it is a matter that the chair of committees raised with all the chairpersons last year. Those were the announcements that I was going to update ourselves on. The last one is that next week, Wednesday, we are supposed to have a committee meeting, but that day is a human rights day. Not that a committee meeting violates a human rights day, but that is a holiday.
Human rights day violates the
protocol. It could be. So there's no meeting. The secretary was just advising me. They gave me a short note that there will be no meeting because we were planning to go to Pretoria Thursday, Friday. So there will be no committee meeting. And with that, the meeting is adjourned. And thank you very much for your constructive inputs and engagement for our members. Thank you.